From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning, filling in for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. On this edition of Fresh Air, Ray Mendez talks with us about some of his best friends: cockroaches, huge moths, and naked mole rats. Mendez is a bug wrangler, and you can see his handiwork in the movie The Silence of the Lambs. Also, Mario Van Peebles talks with us about drugs, dreams, and his new movie, New Jack City. And we have a review of Albert Brooks' film, Defending Your Life. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams said today that there was no way to confirm Iranian reports that Iraqi helicopters have dropped sulfuric acid on civilians, but he did say that Iraq is using combat helicopters against civilians in violation of the temporary ceasefire agreement. We have more from NPR's Neil Conan.
The Pentagon spokesman said armed Iraqi combat helicopters have been active in both the northern and southern parts of the country. As to what they're doing, he said they're shooting at civilians. They're strafing insurgent forces, he said. Williams said that was a violation of the terms of the temporary ceasefire, but he would not be drawn on what the United States might do about it. Repeatedly asked if U.S. forces would shoot down Iraqi combat helicopters, Williams refused to say, and he conceded that the U.S. position is ambiguous. The Pentagon spokesman said that fighting continued in Iraq today. In the north, he said rebel forces were fighting in the eastern part of the city of Kirkuk, while government forces were still in the western part of that city. He also said there was fighting around the major northern city of Mosul and around Karbala in the south. This is Neil Conan reporting.
The Red Cross announced today that Iraq has released 1,100 Kuwaitis in accordance with the temporary ceasefire agreement. Officials said the Kuwaiti prisoners were bused to a remote town on the Saudi border. They were to be flown to Kuwait aboard chartered planes. So far, there's been no information released on who the freed Kuwaitis are and how many of them may be civilians or soldiers. Iraq has now freed about 2,400 Kuwaiti captives and is thought to hold almost 4,000 others. Iraqi officials were in Riyadh today to discuss ways to speed up the return of the nearly 60,000 Iraqi prisoners of war held by the Allies. President Bush today condemned the recent beating of an unarmed black suspect by Los Angeles police. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president spared few words in describing his reaction after seeing the videotape of the Los Angeles incident.
What I saw made me sick. It was sickening to see the beating that was rendered. There's no way, in my view, to explain that away. It was outrageous.
That reaction came in a photo opportunity with Attorney General Richard Thornburg, who has initiated a Justice Department review of the Los Angeles incident and other reports of police brutality. The president, however, refused to join the call for L.A. Police Chief Daryl Gates' resignation.
I think the man's entitled to a credible hearing here. That's the way it ought to be. And nobody's going to prejudge anybody here. What we're going to do is look into violations of the law and prosecute any of the people that have violated the federal law and speak out against police brutality.
I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Stock prices came to a mixed close on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 16 points to close at 2,855.45. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Philippine President Corazon Aquino said today that Imelda Marcos will be allowed to return home, but she'll have to face criminal charges. Marcos, the widow of former Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos, created a stir last week in New York when she applied for a Philippine passport. Mrs. Marcos said she wants permission to bury her husband's remains in their homeland. Marcos' opponents fear that her return could focus anti-government sentiment. The Philippine government would like to try Marcos for embezzlement. If she were convicted in a Philippine court, it would be possible for the government to recover some $350 million now held in Switzerland. NASA has unveiled a scaled-down version of its proposed space station. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
NASA has spent the last 5 months trimming, slashing, and cutting corners, attempting to design a space station that would meet the approval of Congress and the White House. NASA Administrator Richard Truly says the new space station would cost about $29.3 billion, roughly $8 billion less than the original plan. $4 billion has already been spent on design concepts since President Reagan proposed the station in 1984. Some scientists are already calling the new design a waste of money. The Senate will begin hearings on the new design next month, and if it meets with congressional approval, work could begin by 1996 and be ready for operation by 1997. NASA will break ground on a new space station processing facility at the Kennedy Space Center next Tuesday. The building will be the largest construction project undertaken at Kennedy since the Apollo era. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The eight-member presidential committee that governs Yugoslavia agreed today to resume talks on the Federation's future. The agreement comes after days of deadlock when so many members of the committee quit that the group was unable to muster a quorum. The state news agency reported that leaders of Yugoslavia's six republics will meet in the next few weeks. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Cockroaches, they say, will inherit the Earth after we humans finish incinerating ourselves. And sometimes it seems that they won't even wait that long. In Washington at the Smithsonian Institution, there was a display once of a 1950s-style kitchen sink and cabinet. It was a model of what might happen in your kitchen if there were no poison, no predators, no scouring powder, all of those things that you use to keep the cockroaches in check. You'd open a drawer in the display and find that it was filled with hundreds of hard-shelled brown bugs crawling through the cornflakes. Plates and dishes were covered, too. Ropes of cockroaches climbing on top of each other, hanging from the faucets and the knobs. Well, today my guest is Raymond Mendez. He hangs out with and makes his living from cockroaches, among other bugs. He is a bug wrangler for the movies and an entomologist. He lives in what many people probably consider the bug capital of the world, New York City. Welcome to Fresh Air, Ray.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Why bugs?
Why bugs? Well, in general, it's why insects. But for me, it's a matter of looking at animals that live in a totally different continuum from us. They don't relate to us on very many levels. You can't say hello to a roach and have it wag its tail or pet a water bug or anything else like that. And that's fascinated me, the entire concept of aliens among us.
Probably most people at the moment might have a sense of your handiwork in the movie Silence of the Lambs. You did the moth scenes, these moths that appear to have the image of a skull on their backs. How did you do that?
Right. Well, we couldn't find that moth. The moth that the death-head moth, per se, is an Asian moth and was unavailable. We couldn't get them in either by permit or there were no breeders who had them in the country. So we went with its kissing cousin, which is the tomato hornworm. And that's a moth that anybody who's kept a garden with the tomato plants will have found a large green caterpillar crawling amongst their plants as they busily eat everything up. That's the larval form to this particular moth. And then what I did is we took the adult moths, which are raised commercially by geneticists and other researchers, and I brushed the scales off the back of the moth, and then by using fake nails, painted what the correct back looks like for one of the other species, the death-head moth, and then put it on with a special glue so that the moth looked like it had this costume on. So it looked like a death head moth. And then into that costume was built in a little flying harness so that we could then harness the moth up and get it to fly where we wanted it to.
A moth is strong enough to still fly with all of that put on top of it?
The moths themselves are very strong. And we're talking about a moth with a 4-inch wingspan and almost a 3-inch body. And also, they're built for speed. So they didn't have any problems at all with the equipment. And it was very, very light, so no sweat.
How do you control moths, cockroaches, all of these bugs, all of these insects, excuse me? How do you control them?
Well, there are several ways of doing it. One is with the lights. You can present the lights. If the moth is attracted to lights, you can set up the lights in one corner of the room and just let the moths go in the room, and then they'll fly to the lights. The other thing that can be done is flying harnesses, which are what I've specialized in building over the last few years. And you have to find the center of gravity of the moth. And because the exoskeleton, their skeletons are on the outside, flex as they fly, it was really a matter of not only designing a harness that would stick to the animal, but finding a glue that was very flexible yet very strong, and then getting a wire that was almost invisible. We use a steel wire, which is 0.001 millimeters in size, thinner than most people's hair, so that I can fly a moth right in the middle of a set and you won't see the wire. And the moths initially...
You're holding onto a guy wire connected to the wire that's molded to the moth.
And if I have a fishing rod. And sometimes I'm holding three or four fishing rods. I have very lightweight graphite fishing rods that I manipulate very much like a puppeteer does. That's one of two ways. The other we've made injectors to shoot roaches through mannequins where the animals aren't hurt. Imagine making a giant syringe out of 4-inch PVC pipe and then putting the roaches inside and making a coupling under your chest, under a mannequin of your chest, and then pushing the roaches through as if you were pushing liquid out of a syringe, except that they burst through the covering, and then you get an oozing of roaches. So that was one of the ways we did them in Creepshow.
As though the roaches were sort of crawling up out of your
right.
guts through your navel and all of
That's
that.
That's right. And you do it very slowly so that it doesn't look unnatural. It should look like they're walking out. It shouldn't look like they're pouring out. And we actually, for Creepshow, we had a little tube around the outer part of the syringe, which injected fake blood. So just as the roaches were climbing through, they were bathed in a shower of fake blood. So as they came through, they would leave little tracks of blood behind them. Fun, huh?
Yeah. Well, that was the movie as well, wasn't it? Where you had to sort of build a roach corral, and maybe you can tell us that story. And the roaches actually became close to you.
Oh, well, yeah, there was one scene there. In that case, I had to stand. I was in the middle of an enclosed room where we had set up a foam core or a light foam cardboard around us to make a corral. And then you saw the rest of the room, which was lit by lightning, hypothetically. And I'm hiding behind the kitchen wall. So I filled a bucket with roaches. We had maybe about 15,000 roaches in this bucket. And then we had a chemical on the top that would keep them from climbing out. And I held it, and when the director said, now, I had to pour the roaches in a wave-like form, so it looked like they were pouring out of the kitchen, and then I had to go and squat in the corner in this little crack of an area where the camera couldn't see me until the scene was taken. Well, I was wearing a paper outfit, so the roaches couldn't get into any part of my body. And the roaches then just came back and crawled all over me. So I was covered head to foot in the roaches that had come back into the room as well as the ones that had gone away. So after the take, I stood up and walked out towards the front of the area so that everybody could help getting the roaches off me. And the look on people's faces was worth $1 million because you had to take it from my point of view. I'm standing behind my eyes looking out at everybody, and the looks were pure horror. I mean, it was better than any horror show you've ever seen. And the cameraman who was supposed, we on every movie set, there's a cameraman who takes stills for publicity reasons. The cameraman who was taking the stills couldn't even move his camera. He was frozen in place. So they came over and they beat the roaches off me with towels, and then we collected them all up. And I asked him, did you get any shots? And he said, oh, I forgot I had a camera. Like, I was totally freaked out. So that was probably one of the strangest movie incidences I've had with this kind of work.
Most of the insects you use, or I suppose all of the insects you use, are laboratory-raised. But what happens after you've provided a herd of roaches or moths to a film? Do they simply get killed?
In Creepshow, we did. We ended up gassing them. Some of the larger roaches, which I'd actually gone to the tropics to collect, went to museums and other culturals that had permits to keep them. I mean, one of the situations with any of these animals is they reproduce in huge numbers. So we probably started with 26,000 roaches in Creepshow. But by the time the movie was truly done with all the babies that had been born, we'd probably quadrupled the numbers. But they were still small. It's not a situation where these animals would normally not be being destroyed in huge numbers in the wild. Otherwise, the world would literally be saturated with them. In Silence of the Lambs, what we did was different. I took the moths that we used, kept them in flight cages, and then collected the eggs and sent the eggs to the laboratory that had given us the moths initially, from which we bought them, so that their progeny continued. And in that case, I had no problems. There's a continuation that goes right through. The animals lived their normal lifespan. While they were mating, eating, and laying eggs, they also happened to work in a movie. But they didn't suffer from it. Even the ones that had the flying harnesses and the little costumes on, because they're such a big, strong insect, were able to reproduce normally and lay eggs.
My guest is Raymond Mendez, entomologist, bug wrangler. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Raymond Mendez. The other day, a book came in from Princeton University Press called The Biology of the Naked Mole Rat.
Yes.
I've never seen a naked mole rat, but there's a picture on the cover of this book. I have to say it's one of the most vile-looking things I've ever seen in a photograph, and I probably can live quite happily without ever seeing one in my kitchen.
Right.
But I understand you're very fond of naked mole rats. Well, with apologies to the queasiness of some listeners, maybe you could describe what a naked mole rat is and what you do with them.
Okay. A friend of mine several years ago called up and said to me that they had finally found it. And amongst those of us who literally grew up in science, the entire concept of an animal, a mammal, which would have a social system like a wasp or a termite, has always been something that's been talked about but never found. And they had found one in Kenya, in Africa, and it was a cold-blooded mammal with a queen and workers and soldiers and males or consorts, because she has more than one husband, so to speak. And they lived underground in this very complex society. Well, I was, you know, intellectually just totally turned on trying to find out more about them. Now, they're not pretty. Not by anybody's stretch of the imagination. Imagine a hot dog with loose skin, four legs, and teeth. That's pretty much what they look like. But biologically, they are an incredible animal. And we are now currently designing an exhibit for the Philadelphia Zoo where we're going to display them. And I'm going to have the privilege of actually showing them to the public on the David Letterman show. We're going to have some live naked mole rats to show everybody.
And, that'll be a treat.
Yeah. Oh, they fit in the palm of your hand, and they're an animal that comes from an environment which is so poor in food that if you look at why would you form a society in which you give up the right to have any children, and in which you raise the children of, let's say, your sister, and this goes on for generation after generation, and only your sister has food, has children. The reason that this developed is because of the fact they live in an environment where it takes many, 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 many individuals to get enough extra food to raise only a few children. So everybody couldn't be having pups, or you'd end up with no one surviving.
Well, what do they eat? What is their food source?
They eat tubers. And they live in the desert, and they live in a desert-like environment. They live in an environment which has been stable for probably hundreds of thousands of years. And therefore, the temperature of the ground, because it's in the equatorial region, the ground temperature remains constant within 1 or 2 degrees. This means they didn't need to regulate their body temperature because their environment was always the same. So, A, they lost fur, so they're naked, or they've lost all their body hair. They didn't need it. And the other thing they lost the ability to do is to regulate their body temperature as we do. If you get cold, you shiver, and you can raise your body temperature by shivering. They can't do that. If they get cold, they either go to sleep or they die. If they get too hot, they can't pant. They die. So it's an animal that has no way of regulating its body temperature and is hairless, practically blind, living in these underground burrows with a very complicated social system for developing a queen. And as I said, the consorts and the scientists for years, when they had or for a period of time, had these nests of them in captivity, right? And they had these very big individuals that just laid around, And they didn't do anything. And nobody could figure out what was going on. They didn't work. They didn't push anybody around. They didn't try to mate with the queen. They didn't have babies. They just sat around. Well, one of the researchers at Cornell put a tube in the run, and he put dirt on one side, and he put a small snake in the middle. And then he put dirt on the other side. So the snake was trapped in a little chamber. And then he attached that to the nest chamber of the naked mole rats. Well, the workers found the plugged up burrow and went busily away cleaning it out and throwing all the dirt out. And they hit the snake. Well, when they hit the snake where the snake was, they started whistling in this particular pattern. These guys, they have calls that sound like bird calls that travel very, very well underground in these tunnels. And they started squeaking. And lo and behold, these big guys that had just been laying around for all this time doing nothing got up and all attacked down that burrow. And what he discovered was that they had soldiers, but they'd never used them because they'd never been in need for them. So they're still learning about them in this book.
So the smaller mole rats were the scouts, and then the samurai, I suppose, were sort of lounging around in the back.
Right. They were waiting for a need to use them. They do two things. The small guys do most of the digging. And the food gathering. The big fellas are soldiers, and also they go to they make what they call volcanoes. They dig a little, in order to move the dirt out of the burrows, they make a little hole, and then one fellow sits while everybody else passes the dirt to him or her, because the workers are both male and female, pass the dirt to them, and then they just kick it out of the burrow. So it looks like a volcano, and so they call them that. The dirt is coming up in the air. So the big guys both do the heavy-duty earth moving at the end of the tunnel, flipping it all out, and act as soldiers within the nest itself. These guys have, the teeth are very strong. As I said, they dig in soil, which is like laterite, almost like red brick. So they can go through clear plastic tubing with a quarter-inch wall. They will actually dig through the plastic. That's how strong their teeth are.
You really like all these animals, don't you?
Oh yeah, it's a lifelong pursuit, and it's like a never-ending novel, like the greatest suspense story you could think of, with no ending, just goes on and on, and all you get are little tidbits that make you want to go and read more. So it's great. No complaints from the kid.
Well, bugs, snakes, you know, rats. These are all the creatures that you seem really to love. I mean, you make your livelihood from them, and yet the movies that hire you pretty much use all of these creatures as emblems of evil, as sort of signs of almost like a submerged inner evil. If you go back and look at these movies, does that make you feel a little strange?
Oh, yeah, because there's two things. What interested me about insects, what started me in this path of studying them and working with them and looking at them was a fascination for other, what is so different about them from us. Now, I use it in a positive sense. To me, it's fascinating, and I want to study it, and I want to learn more about it, and I want to see what's going on. To other people, things that are other and different are things to be destroyed, act negatively towards, or avoided. And that's how the movies use them. They use that part of it. I'm aware of that. You can't grow up going up to your friends and saying, wow, look at this, you know, bug, and you open up your hands and half of the crowd runs away at full speed, not to realize that everybody doesn't have the same feeling about wildlife that I have. But it's that otherness, non-communication, things that appear where you have no control, or things that are living there even though you don't know they're living there because there's no way you've known that they were there. That's what the movies are using. It doesn't bother me as long as I also know that there's wonderful programs on the Nature or the Public Broadcasting Service and National Geographic and other programs which are working to educate people towards the other end of the light spectrum. But
wait a minute. You're saying, though, that you're really contributing to people whose idea of the world is that otherness is evil. I mean, and they're using your bugs to help push this idea of the evilness of something that's strange. I mean, this has got to be a bit of a problem for you.
No, because I look at it all as play. And there's a dark side to play and there's a light side to play. And as long as it stays play, I mean, if there was a... I have, for instance, worked on commercials for different types of manufacturers where they try to present incorrect data or incorrect information about animals as if it is the truth. In that case, I have a problem. And I stated it. I have, in some cases, not worked on projects like that. And I make sure that they understand that what they're doing is incorrect. On the other hand, when you're taking a movie and you're talking about fantasy, I mean, we're talking about a guy who's a cannibal in this movie. I mean, talk about the dark side. There's another fellow who's in the story that's equally evil or sick. But it's a flight of fantasy. It's not reality. So in that respect, that's the dark side of playing. The actual project itself is very stimulating, and working with people and creating that kind of eerie feelings is a real high. It's fun to work on movies if you look at it like that, and that's how I see it. I was never one of the kids who used animals to control other people. I'm sure that in your life you've met somebody who took a snake and shoved it in the little girl's face in order to make her scream. And that way, I'm better than you are because I have the animal and I can control it. It's almost voodoo. You know, it's very gut-oriented kind of manipulation of your fellow citizens. Never played that game. Never thought it was interesting. Always was much more interested in saying, no, don't be afraid of it. Look what it does. Look what it eats. I have a real basic belief system in that. But that's another, you know, that's another side to the kids being afraid anyways. I've had many people, I teach kids quite often in the school systems here in New York. And I've had the kids write me letters saying, gee, you know, you made holding a tarantula interesting, and I never thought I would do it, and thank you for teaching me about it, but I still think they're ucky and terrible.
Do you have roaches in your apartment in New York City?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact.
But what do you do about them?
Well, I have two different kinds. One is a green tree roach, which I actually have in culture. It's a beautiful roach, emerald green in color, and it only eats fresh fruit, so there's no chances of it getting away and inhabiting human homes. And the other type is when we moved into the apartment in New York City, there's the German roach. By the way, a lot of these names have to do with particular prejudices, the German roach having gotten its name I believe it was the First World War, when nobody was particularly pleased with the Germans, so they had a roach that came from Northern Africa, but they said, that's a German, so it became a German roach, just to show you where these names, these names can develop.
Tell me what you do to control them.
Well, the German roaches we got rid of by introducing a different species of roach, the brown banded roach, which is very aggressive and gets rid of them and also keeps very low numbers. And I keep them in control by putting containers that have a roach poison in them, and they eat it and they die.
Roach motels.
Yeah, little roach motels.
So you use roaches to kill roaches, and then you kill the killers.
And then I kill the killers. And it just keeps a nice population that these are very pretty roaches, and when I see them, they don't bother me.
My guest is Raymond Mendez. He is an entomologist, bug wrangler, or perhaps more appropriately an insect wrangler. Thanks for being here, Ray.
No, thank you, Frank.
This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Frank Browning with Fresh Air. The new movie, New Jack City, has been called controversial because of several violent incidents during the first screenings of the film. But Mario Van Peebles, the film's director and co-star, calls New Jack City a movie that even Nancy Reagan would say yes to. Coming up, a conversation with Mario Van Peebles. Then, can Albert Brooks and Meryl Streep find love and contentment after they're both dead? Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Brooks' new movie, Defending Your Life. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Pentagon officials say Iraqi troops are using helicopters to attack anti-government forces and warned again that helicopter flights violate a temporary ceasefire in the Persian Gulf War. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams would not say if U.S. fighters might shoot down Iraqi helicopters. Williams also said the U.S. cannot confirm rebel charges, that napalm and acid are being used by Iraqi government forces against civilians. A human rights organization, Middle East Watch, says that up to 2,000 non-Kuwaitis are being held in Kuwait and at least 40 people have been killed since the Persian Gulf War ended. Tim Luckhurst of the BBC reports from Kuwait City.
Middle East Watch say that there has been a pattern of indiscriminate roundups, torture and beatings of non-Kuwaitis since the liberation. Most of the victims are Palestinians, but Iraqis and citizens of countries which supported Iraq's invasion of Kuwait are also suffering. The detainees have been seized at roadblocks or arrested as the result of tip-offs to the army and police. Andrew Whitley, executive director of Middle East Watch, said that many of these tip-offs were based on personal grudges. Several detainees had been summarily executed. There was evidence that some torture techniques, such as burning with cigarettes, branding, and the dripping of hot candle wax onto sensitive parts of the body, had been copied from the Iraqi occupation forces. Mr. Whitley said that the detention and torture was carried out by Kuwaiti soldiers inside police stations, schools and other official buildings, including hospitals. He said the government of Kuwait knew what was happening.
Tim Luckhurst of the BBC in Kuwait City. In Yugoslavia, the latest political crisis appeared to ease with a successful meeting of the collective federal presidency to decide the future political model of the country. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Belgrade.
Presidents of the various Yugoslav republics joined the collective leadership in a special session. The presidents agreed to meet again on a regular basis to continue their dialogue and to try to find what a communique called peaceful and democratic solutions to the crisis. Only a few days ago, Yugoslavia appeared to be on the verge of civil war or a military coup d'etat. But the Belgrade meeting ended on an optimistic note. Observers see it as a result of a chastening of the Serbian leader, Slobodan Milosevic, whose uncompromising stand last week had raised fears of a rapid and perhaps dramatic disintegration of the country. But the Serbian hardline communist no longer appeared able to set his conditions, following mass anti-communist protests in Belgrade and the traditionally pro-Serb army's decision not to interfere in Yugoslav political affairs. In Belgrade, this is Sylvia Pojoli.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 16 points to close at 2,855.45 on volume of some 200 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 8-7. This is NPR News. According to U.S. Navy officials, two U.S. Navy airplanes collided this morning off the coast of Southern California, and 27 people are missing. Search teams have found some debris, but have found no bodies or survivors. The planes were on a training mission from Moffett Naval Air Station in Northern California. Officials say they are not sure if bad weather played a part in the accident. Several alternatives to the Bush administration's national energy plans have been introduced in Congress. Legislation proposed by Colorado Democrat Tim Wirth and another package supported by House Republicans both go further than the Bush administration in the area of energy efficiency and conservation. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more.
Dozens of energy bills have been introduced since the Persian Gulf crisis underscored the country's reliance on foreign oil. But it's questionable whether any major energy package will emerge now that the war is over and the price of gas is again low. House Minority Leader Bob Michael unveiled a Republican energy package today.
We would do well to heed what we just come through and outline as best we can to the American public. It could happen again.
The debate that's shaping up in Congress over energy legislation will most likely fall along regional rather than political lines. The most controversial proposals include requiring automakers to build more fuel-efficient cars, opening up Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil exploration and drilling, and boosting the nation's capacity to produce nuclear power. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Also in Washington, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says that front seat automatic crash protection, such as airbags, will now be required in vans, light trucks, and small buses. It's already required in new cars. A spokesman says the agency will phase in the new orders over 4 years. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
Hustler, word, I pull the trigger long, grip my teeth, spray to every nigga's gone. Got my block sewn on my dope spot. Last thing I sweat, so suck a punk cop. Move like a king when I roll hop. You try to flex, bang, another bang. Nigga drop. You gotta deal with this, cause in the way out, why? Cash money ain't never gonna play out. I got nothing to lose.
Money. New Jack City, starring rap singer Ice-T, is the number two grossing film in this country. It's a story about the making of a black drug lord in Harlem, about the greed decade of the 80s, and about whether law enforcement institutions really give a damn about drugs in the ghettos. It's also a film about violence, whose producers have seen violence erupt at some theaters where it's showing. Mario Van Peebles directed New Jack City. He says it's a movie whose time is now.
Well, first of all, you have to understand this is all cyclical. It was like about 20 years ago to the month that my father directed, I call him Melvin Van Movies, but he's Melvin Van Peebles, directed, wrote, produced, starred in Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which was out in the movie theaters. And when that opened up, only two theaters in the whole United States would play it, and it broke all the box office records. It became the top independent grossing hit for 1971 or 70, I think it was 71. And after that, the studio said, gee, you know, these colored movies, this might make some money here. So after that, the studios, which are, of course, white, made Shaft and Superfly and started to make what became known as the blaxploitation, where you had basically white folks making money from black actors, you know, shooting up whatever they were shooting up. I don't remember what they were shooting at, but they were shooting at something. And those movies got worse and worse until they weren't happening anymore. And then Hollywood said, well, I guess colored movies aren't making money. And so it's taken that long for, you know, it's to the pendulum to swing back where they say, well, you know, Spike did okay and Eddie Murphy did okay and Cosby's doing okay. So in that climate, they look over at me and say, hey, you know, he's the son of Melvin Van Peebles and he's been directing. I directed Wise Guys and Jump Streets and a lot of television and after school specials and whatnot. So they gave me a shot. Warner Brothers called me in and along with the producers, Doug McHenry and George Jackson, gave us a shot to do New Jack City, which is basically based on a drug lord in Harlem. And when
right.
I read
and articles that were in the Village Voice about that scene, right?
I mean, it's so authentic. When you see New Jack City, the way they make the crack is authentic, except for they have less clothing on. There's less violence in the movie that really is a part of that lifestyle. The way they walk the guy down the street naked happened on 125th Street. So there's so much of it, the way they computerize the drug thing, and so you don't get caught in a hand-to-hand buy. Rafael Edmonds and Felix Mitchell did that. So a lot of it is really, really based in reality, the way the guy turned state's evidence at the end. But New Jack City goes beyond being an indictment of a gangster to being an indictment of the system that created that gangster. And that's where I think the real controversy is.
Well, let's talk about that indictment. I mean, the junkie.
Chris Rock, yeah.
Yeah, he wears, the junkie wears an American flag shirt.
Right, there's a lot of...
So why?
Because what Judd Nelson says in the movie, Judd Nelson plays one of the cops, and Judd says, you know, this drug epidemic, it's not a black thing, it's not a white thing, it's a death thing, and death doesn't care what color you are. And I wanted to get back to the fact that really this doesn't just affect the black community. It affects all the communities, and it affects white kids too. There's a lot of perception in the black communities that if drugs is just wiping out blacks in the inner cities, then no one gives a damn. You know, as Nino Brown says in the end of New Jack City, Nino the gangster, he says, look, you can take me to jail. That's cool. But understand something. We don't make Uzis up in Harlem. That's an Israeli weapon. Someone over there is getting paid. We don't have poppy fields in Harlem. That's ridiculous. There's no one in Harlem that has a poppy field. These drugs get there in a big quantity because it's a big business, and they all know that. And so it's not just an inner city thing. And so there are a lot of people that I feel that as long as it's in the inner city, no one really cares.
George Mansour, who is a film curator at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston and mm-hmm. has been a film booker for a long time, right. says that he said something interesting. He said that what's really going on here is that nice middle-class people really don't seem to want to have anything to do with the kind of people they imagine who are going to see New Jack City. And that actually is almost verbatim what a very sort of progressive, liberal-minded white friend of mine said, that I don't think I want to go there. It's not the kind of scene I want to be in. I want you to step out of Hollywood for a moment right. and tell me what you think's going on.
That's a valid point. I mean, movies are for, I think, all Americans, and if you don't want to go to a movie because you're afraid a certain segment of the population will go, and I guess you can see it when it comes to home video if you're interested. But those people, I think, are really sort of out of the mix anyway. I mean, and if they were in the mix, I think they would probably, maybe understand it. We wouldn't have the problem that we do. The problem is that exactly that, the inner cities have been forgotten, and that you're looking at are forgotten people. I mean, this movie is for those kids that need to be saved. This is for those kids that need to see this movie. This is for, when I did the home show, the lady told me, she said, Mario, I've seen the movie. This is the scared straight of crack. If my kid were even thinking about dealing, I would take him to see this movie.
But those kids,
the kids don't see Gandhi in droves. They really don't. They don't turn out to see a little movie on Chico Mendez in droves. That's all of us adults who have choices in our lives, clapping for ourselves, and it's very nice sort of cinematic masturbation. It doesn't reach the audience that it needs to see it. If you want to make a movie that's anti-drug, you better get it to the kids that need to see it. I have an education, you have an education. If we get hooked on crack, that's on us. I mean, we had the choice. What I'm talking about reaching is the audience that don't have a choice.
And those people who say, no, this is just a cookbook for kids to learn how to do violence,
they haven't seen the movie. They just haven't seen the movie. They said that about rock and roll. They'll say that about, they just haven't seen the movie. And, you're always going to get people like that, that make judgments without reading the books. Like my grandmother said, don't judge a book by its cover. But we all know better than that. We just tend to do that. I know I do that. I go, well, I probably know what that movie's about. But in the case of New Jack City, this is one of the first strong anti-drug movies that kids are turning out in droves to see. Kids of all colors. You can't open a movie like New Jack City in only 825 theaters across America and make $7 million your first weekend and beat Hard Way, which is at 1,600 theaters, by $1 million without kids, both white and black, going out to see this movie. And now the adults are starting to go.
Mario Van Peebles is my guest. He is the director of the film New Jack City. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Mario Van Peebles is my guest. He's the director of New Jack City.
I'm still here and talking away.
And a woman, a black woman, who I was talking to just this morning, who works with us here, who says, well, what about the women in this movie? What do we learn about women in this movie? We learn that they can shoot, too, mm-hmm. and that they can get shot. And, mm-hmm. well, I suppose, yes, there is a lawyer who, for a very short period of time, but mostly maybe what you learn is that women can get in the way of buddy love between two men.
Hmm. That's interesting. First of all, you have to understand, when you make a movie in 90 minutes, you can't get too preachy. If you do a movie, New Jack City, one of the biggest things about it we got was how authentic it was. And we got a super high score from young women, a super high score. They were very surprised at how high the score was from young women. And you can't make a movie and say, well, God, I got to make it incumbent upon this movie to deal with a pregnant Puerto Rican problem or the women thing or the, you know, you've got to really make a movie and tell the story. But in that story, I like to open it up. I mean, the Asian cop in New Jack City doesn't have a big role, but I think it's important that he's there. And when, let me give you an example. When I remember as a kid seeing Humphrey Bogart movies, you probably did too. When I watched him, I thought, hey, I'd like to do the Humphrey Bogart role. I mean, I thought if I identified with anyone just like you, it was probably a Humphrey Bogart. Until the black butler would inevitably come on and go, whoa, Mr. Bogart, we got to go stop that. You can't go up there. And you go, gee, if I was born back then, I'd be stuck playing the butler. There's no way I'd get to do this love scene with Lauren Bacall. I can forget it. This dream is not for me. And so what happens is later on when I'm directing finally, I want to just open it up to Americans of all colors. Most of the time when you see a black cop in an action movie, he's the police commissioner. He's got no hair, and he sort of says, bring it in on budget, or I'll have your badge, or, you know, that kind of line, right? You've seen that role before, haven't you?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in New Jack City, first thing they said, well, are you going to make the white guy the police commissioner? And I said, no, I'm not going to do unto them as they've done unto us. I'll do unto them as I'd have them do unto us. And when I went to get an Asian cop, they sent me a couple Asian guys with big round faces and glasses, and they came in going, oh, those are go. And it was like this stereotype. And I laughed at first, and then I realized that was their version of the butler. So in New Jack City, when Russell Wong came in, who's great looking, he's strong, even though it's just a small role, people pick up on that this guy has a leading man thing going on too. And people pick up on, even though the women, the female roles aren't big, there's a woman who's sexy, who's the predator, there's the woman who's the victim, there's the woman who's the gangster, there's a woman who's a lawyer. There's a real mix. So across the board, there's an interesting mix of humanity. And I like to try to do that. Now, you can't change the focus and have a whole paragraph about her saying, well, I'm a woman and I'm a gangster and we can, you know, I mean, you got to stay, you got to tell the story. I mean, you got to be aware of that. You got to tell the story and move it along. These kids go to sleep or they go get gummy bears and you lose your audience. The New Jack City kids come and they hoot and they holler and they cheer when Chris Rock is about to get on crack and they tell him to just say no. And they hoot and holler when the lawyer takes down Nino Brown at the end. I mean, so they're in there and they're rooting for the right side of the equation. And that's an achievement. I mean, most action movies, you just see people get blown up and there's no message that I can think of. Can you?
You've said before that you cast Ice-T into this movie
mm-hmm.
because of the way he uses ghetto Shakespearean prose.
Right.
Well, first of all, what is that? For people who don't know, and it certainly isn't the world that you grew up in.
No, it's not. No, it's not. And again, I mean, I hope that as an artist, I'm not going to be limited to my personal experiences, or I'll make one or two movies and I'll be in big trouble. I mean, Coppola was never in Vietnam, but he did a hell of a job with Apocalypse Now. So I hope that I'll always be able to go beyond my own personal experience. I did work in a drug treatment center.
And what do you mean by ghetto Shakespearean prose?
Okay, I'll give you an example. When I first met Ice-T, I was at this club, and I heard this guy say, yo, 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 if you could take my body, hold it up to a microscope, and see one molecule of my entire system that gave a damn. I turned around and said, who said that, you know? And it was Ice-T. And he had such an authentic street voice. But even more importantly than his voice, Ice-T in his own life rejected drugs, and in his own life was in a gang and got out of a gang and rejected gang violence. So I wanted my cop to be someone that was authentic on the streets, that boys and girls could come in and go, yo, that's Ice-T, man. He used to be in a gang, and he said no to that stuff. And they would come in and emotionally get on board with him. So that was very important. And when Ice-T came into the audition, he said, yo, Van Peebles, I don't know about this acting, but this role comes from the heart.
Do you and your father talk about the sort of the different trajectory of your own two careers in films? I mean, you've been kind of a hot success from the get-go, and he's spent a lifetime struggling at it.
Yeah, I'm just more talented. I mean, I think, you know, I deserve what I get. I'm kidding. I know Dad will kill me when he hears that. I'm kidding. People go, what? No, man. I've had my spells. You know, we all have. I mean, my dad always said, son, there's four phases in your life, you know. First phase is they say, Mario who? Next phase, they say, Mario baby. Next phase, they say, get me a young Mario. And then one day it becomes Mario who again. So, you know, I've seen that happen to my dad. I mean, there was a time when things came easier to him, too. But understand something, 20 years ago was a lot tougher. I mean, Melvin Van Movies had to open the door for the Hudlins and for Spike and myself and all those guys. It was a lot rougher. My first movie, I'm making it for $8.5 million, and I'm in the studio system. His first movie, he had to make it, you know, out of his socks, and it was very tough. So he had a much tougher road.
My guest has been Mario Van Peebles, director of the film New Jack City.
Yo, Dave, you get the sticks. Slim, get the bass. Yo, are you ready to kick it? Here we go.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us from All Things Considered. What's on the program today, Linda?
Frank, we are taking a look at the ceasefire arrangements to see what is possible under those agreements, those tentative agreements, for Iraq to use in the way of planes, helicopters, weapons to put down an insurrection. We'll be talking to refugees crossing the northern border of Iraq, Kurdish refugees telling their stories. Ambassador April Glaspie is back testifying on the House side this time, and we'll try to see if we can find out why she has kept so quiet for so long. And we also have a piece about Hawaii's state fish. It has a very long name. I've been practicing it all afternoon.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The last movie Albert Brooks wrote, directed, and starred in was Lost in America. In his new movie, Brooks leaves the continent and this world. Stephen Schiff has this review.
Albert Brooks has long been the great irritant of movie comedy. Like the late Andy Kaufman, he wants to bug us, to oppress us, and make us antsy. And then finally, when you feel you can't stand his whining or his narcissism a moment longer, he releases his audience with an explosive joke. That kind of comedy is extremely rich and extremely daring, but it doesn't win you hordes of fans, and Brooks has always been a minority taste. He probably hopes his delicious new movie, Defending Your Life, will change all that. It's his sweetest, gentlest comedy yet, and he does his best to turn himself into a fuzzy cuddle bear in it. In fact, his hardcore fans, of which I count myself one, may find that a cuddly Brooks is not quite as lively as the hot pepper Brooks who used to make us steam and squirm. But then, liveliness is beside the point here, because the character Brooks plays in Defending Your Life is dead. This movie is part of the same falling in love with death genre as Ghost, and Always, and a host of fantasies from the 40s. It takes place in the afterlife, specifically in Judgment City, the squeaky clean purgatory where lives are evaluated and cosmic fates determined. Part of the joke is that Judgment City is a middle-brow dream come true, with billboards and bowling alleys and comedy clubs and all the ghastly cafeteria food you can eat. It's a theme park of American tastelessness. There's even a miniature golf course, and that's where Brooks takes the dream girl he's just met. She's played, very winsomely, by Meryl Streep.
You know what, you never told me how you died. How did you die?
I don't want to talk about it.
Why?
It's embarrassing.
Embarrassing? What could be embarrassing? I was hit by a bus.
I tripped.
No.
Yes.
Seriously, you tripped?
Yes.
On what?
We went to visit some friends for the weekend. Everybody wanted to go into town, but I wanted to stay at the house and go swimming, so I went outside, tripped over the chaise lounge, hit my head on the cement, and rolled into the pool.
What did the East German judge give you?
That kind of bouncy banter makes up a lot of this movie, and Brooks and Streep develop an unexpectedly warm chemistry. But what's brilliant about Defending Your Life isn't the punchlines, it's the cosmology. When the dead come to Judgment City, they go on trial, with a prosecutor and a defender and two judges who decide whether their souls will return to Earth for another try or proceed on to some other more marvelous plane. We're put on Earth, it turns out, to conquer fear. And only when we have do we get promoted. Which, by the way, makes us a whole lot smarter. It seems that most of the universe laughingly refers to us Earthlings as the little brains. Even after death, then, the cosmos is based on status, and Brooks has worked out the details with fanatical care. The only place he falls down is in the trial itself. There, despite a hilariously hearty performance by Rip Torn as his back-slapping defender, Brooks can't carry his conceit far enough. The arguments between Torn and snaky Lee Grant as the prosecutor don't have the wit or the intellectual heft they ought to have. And the scenes we see from Brooks' life on Earth are curiously bland. Even so, Defending Your Life is a triumph of comic tone. Brooks manages to make the petty dinkiness of human existence at once appallingly funny and strangely poignant. Beneath his jokes, you can feel a tragic undertow. And besides, this movie offers the definitive answer to one of my own pressing cosmic questions. Is there sushi after death? You bet.
Film critic Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Defending Your Life opens this weekend in New York and Los Angeles, and in other cities early next month. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. The engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Bob Alls, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Fabletis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Frank Browning.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, investigative journalist Scott Armstrong, the founder of the National Security Archives in Washington, turns his attention to the Gulf War. Among his questions, whatever happened to the 200,000 missing Iraqi troops? I'm Frank Browning. That and more on the next Fresh Air.